TED Audio Collective.
Well, hello, Francis.
Hi, beautiful.
I want to talk about all of the needs we meet at work, because the list is longer than simply our financial needs.
Oh, yeah. What are the needs? It's intellectual engagement, curiosity, creativity, learning how to play well with others, being kind, all kinds of needs.
Novelty, connection. I think the list is actually quite long. And I think that one of the experiences we've all been having over the last couple of years between pandemic living and new work from anywhere arrangements, do it anytime. I think part of what's happening in all of this really interesting churn is that list is getting revealed to us.
Yeah, I used to casually interact with so many people. The water cooler, all of right. That. Like, I couldn't go anywhere. In fact, I would sometimes take routes where I would be less likely to interact with people. There were so many, were so many people around.
But even a proud self-described introvert, I think half of the stories you would bring home from work to me happened at the lunch cart.
The coffee cart downstairs. The place where you'll find out if you got fired when your ID swipe no longer works.
Yeah. I'm really excited to get into this with our next caller because of the specific experience of her life, which has been unambiguously extraordinary. I think she's in a really interesting place confronting this truth that there is a need of hers that cannot be met in the workplace as she's currently designed it.
Awesome.
I'm Ann Morris. I'm a company builder and leadership coach.
And I'm Frances Fry. I'm a professor at the Harvard Business School, and I'm Ann's wife.
And this is Fixable from the TED Audio Collective. On this show, we believe that meaningful change happens fast, anything is fixable, and good solutions are usually just a single brave conversation away.
Who are we talking to today, Anne?
Francis, today we have a very special guest, a dear, dear friend of mine. I think my earliest friend, actually, who also happens to be the best-selling novelist, Curtis Sittenfeld.
This sparks so much joy. Any Sittenfeld sparks joy. And this is going to be so fun with Curtis.
Curtis and I grew up together in Cincinnati, right across the street from each other. And she is now the author of 8 incredible books, including Rodham, Prep, her first one, which was a runaway bestseller, and her latest out in 2023, which is Romantic Comedy.
And my favorite thing about Curtis's books is that you often have an appearance in them.
Yes. I like to think of myself as her first muse, if not her best. And she's coming on today because despite her incredible success, or maybe because of it, she's feeling some tension between what her work requires and what she wants to feel walking around the world as a fully integrated human. So I'm really excited to get into this with her. It's something I think about all the time, and we think about a lot of the time, surprisingly, even though our focus is squarely in the workplace.
Yeah, I love this, what do you feel? There's so many emotions that that when we feel and when we think about how do we optimize on those emotions. So I look forward to finding which emotion it is that Curtis wants to feel more of.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey everybody, it's Neil. I've got some huge news. Decoder is moving to Mondays and Thursdays. We're adding a second episode of the show. On Mondays, we'll have our classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers.
I think we're going to have to start having conversations about how do we pay those jobs that can't be done by AI.
And on Thursdays, we'll be explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show.
There's a new generation of people on the internet. Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal. They can just go to TikTok.
This is going to be really fun. I'm very excited about all this. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts now.
Curtis Sittenfeld, welcome to Fixable.
Annie and Francis, thank you so much for having me. This is my dream come true.
I was trying to think of an efficient way to describe our friendship. What I came up with was that I literally can't remember my life before we were friends.
That's true. Yeah. I think we met in the summer of 1978 when we were both two, about to turn three. So you and your mother and your brothers move from St. Louis to Cincinnati, where your mother had grown up. Somehow your moving truck couldn't or wouldn't cross some bridge. So you get to your house and there's no furniture for like a few days. And we have a fold up bed. And so we like collectively, you, your mom and your brothers, me, my mom and my older sister, we all wheel the bed across the street, which I think that must have been one of the most exciting things that had ever happened in my life up to that point. Maybe still. And then I think we somehow all get the bed inside. And I think that your brothers then kind of jump on it. And I was like, those are very wild boys. But I was like, but I think I want to be friends with that girl. Okay. Is this consistent with your...
Yes, it lines up very well. I think what the moving truck couldn't cross was actually a picket line. So I think there was a trucking strike happening at the time. So my mother, who had just lost her husband, my father had died in the previous 6 months, showed up in this new house with three kids under the age of seven, and there was no furniture. And so I remember looking out the window from this empty house, looking out the window, and this family was crossing the street, and there was this little girl who looked like she might be my age trailing behind. And destiny took hold from there. But I remember thinking, okay, this is maybe not going to be so bad in this scary new place.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Day one, you meet Curtis Sittenfeld. That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
And then, you know, we proceeded to spend 7 million hours like eating Cool Ranch Doritos in your attic.
And we did eat a lot of Doritos. We watched a lot of Days of Our Lives. But pretty early on in the trajectory of the friendship, you started writing stories. And so it was...
About you. No.
Well, I wasn't going to bring it up. But you started churning out stories that I think to my 8-year-old brain at an astonishing pace. And so this idea that you are now like world famous literary rock star makes a ton of sense to little Annie. And so just to like establish the fact pattern here, you're like 5 or 6 New York Times bestsellers in, am I counting correctly?
That's an interesting thing to count. I've written 8 books. That's how I count.
Well, we're a little competitive on this side of the screen. Yeah. So this is a show about work. And I'm curious if you remember making a decision that writing was going to be your life's work.
I mean, I don't think that I realistically anticipated that I would be a novelist and that would be my job. I think I probably thought or hoped that writing fiction would be at the center of my life. And I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop and got an MFA. I mean, it is truly like a very privileged position to be a full-time fiction writer. And most people are also, you know, maybe they teach creative writing at college, or their English teachers, or they're journalists, or I have many friends who have like successful acclaimed books and do essentially more kind of like gig based, like maybe they help quote unquote coach college applicants as they write their essays, or maybe they do tutoring,
quote unquote,
or maybe they
coach. It's a brutal marketplace.
Yeah. Anyway, I actually worked at a business magazine. I worked at Fast Company magazine in the late 90s, which I think kind of affirmed to me that like I was an English major. I think they were like, we'll have you do the colorful profiles of wacky people. I always knew that writing fiction was very central to my life. I don't know that I thought I could build a career, or probably I didn't. There was a long time when I didn't even know what that looked like.
So let's start here, and then I want to back up a little for more context. But Curtis, what's the problem you want to tackle today?
Okay. I'm so glad you asked. So I feel really lucky. I feel very grateful. I do think, in early 2020, like late 2019, early 2020, I think I was like, you know, I've been working from home, you know, by myself full time since 2005. So it had been like 15 years at that point. And I was like, I'm getting a little bored and restless. Like, I think I'm going to make some changes and go out into the world and like, you know, rub shoulders with other people, which
you timed that very well.
I know. And then of course, you know, there's this stretch of thinking like, oh my God, like if I go to the grocery store and, you know, like don't get sick or something, that's like a victory. But I do. I think that it took me 20 years to feel the thing that some people felt after like 4 days in lockdown, which is kind of like, I'm really isolated. And it's kind of complicated because, you know, you sort of go into this parallel universe writing fiction. And I think the same thing that allows me to be productive and have this career that I really value isolates me, which is that I literally spend a lot of time by myself. It's not like I'm so chatty because you're the first people I've interacted with today.
Great. So the target here is to resolve some of the tension around the isolation you're experiencing at work. And it does seem like the core activities of writing a novel are a solo sport. Are there any aspects of it that are less isolating, like working with your editor or sharing pages with your fellow writers?
Yes, but for me, actually, let's say I write a 300-page book, show it. I might show like 4 pages to my editor to give her the flavor, but I probably wouldn't show it to her until the entire thing existed. I like to take it as far as I can take it before showing it to other people. So that is a really valuable part of the process, but it's close to the end. And I could go 2 years without it.
And what about, I just want to underscore, you could go 2 years before that part of your work becomes a collective experience in any way. Yeah.
I could go 2 years, and I have friends. I have one friend who spent like 10 years writing a novel. I have another who spent 18 years writing a novel.
Oh my God.
So
right.
2 years is
all right.
Nothing.
So this is not where we're going to find community. And then what about kind of the writing adjacent aspects of your job where you are promoting the book, you are potentially, you know, responding to fans or mentoring other writers? Do those activities naturally bring you into contact with other humans? And are those activities energizing or meaningful to you?
Yes. I mean, I guess there's a few, those are sort of different categories. So I am kind of in a few programs formally as a mentor. And I do find that, you know, gratifying and interesting. And as with other workplaces, like I meet someone I wouldn't otherwise have met, and I can have that feeling, which I assume I like that. I mean, it's not like a daily thing. I think my isolation and boredom are daily, and not daily. Like, the being a mentor is not daily. It's interesting. So if I do a book event that I am either wearing pajama-ish clothing during the work day and I'm like, you know, like to the naked eye, it would look like I'm like having a sick day or like whatever. And then even though it's like a standard work day for me, or I'm in this very public professional mode, and like it's not like there's something kind of strange about either, you know, like being by myself, like looking into the existential void, or being treated, you know, like a quasi celebrity at events. That's like, it's like a kind of feast or famine situation that I think creates maybe a little like psychological imbalance or something.
And that psychological imbalance that you feel on a regular basis, is there an emotion that you associate with that?
I mean, maybe it's like being on or being off, and I want some middle ground. Like, I don't want to either be performing my what I hope to be my most charismatic self, or I don't know, just like having super dirty hair and like, you know, like eating salad with my hands. Like, hypothetically.
No, I feel the tension. It's super vivid. I feel the tension. And what's the language you associate with the tension? It feels bad. What else? How else would you describe that tension?
Like it feels sort of like I can manage both, but it feels like being overly visible or invisible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's nice.
Which doesn't feel great. I want to, you know, I think this conversation is really, well, potentially interesting to our listeners, because in some ways I feel like you are a messenger from the future, because you've been thinking about this tension between work and isolation and community for decades, and the rest of us are like a couple years in as the workplace now evolves, and we're all going to be doing a lot more of our work separated, at least technically, from other human beings.
Well, so there is one, I think, major step that I have taken, which is in early 2023, three other writer friends and I started meeting every Monday at 1 o'clock for lunch. And we actually said we're gonna do a Google Doc where we talk about like essentially our writing goals for the next month. It's really a joy, and it's not a writing group.
It's a group of writers.
Yes, exactly. We might show our writing to each other at some point, but in this moment, it might be like somebody might even say, like, I haven't been able to work because I'm switching like my bedroom and my home office, and I need to paint the office, and then but my goal is to be writing by next Thursday or something like that. So, and I actually think that has been a wonderful thing, sort of professionally, socially. There is some form of light accountability. Like, it's not like a deadline and no one cares, but you've sort of spoken it into the world, and so you yourself know what your goal is.
I think that's awesome, and I think an awesome antidote to the isolation you were describing. My question is, how much of the problem did that solve?
Well, okay. I think like having lunch every Monday with my friends solved the problem for Monday. But then there's four other weekdays. But, and again, I feel confused because if I overschedule things, then, you know, like I had a grad school friend who would talk about getting ready to get ready. And so it's like, if you have something at 10:15 in the morning, I might think, well, there's no point in actually trying to write 3 pages because by the time my hair dries or whatever, like from the shower, like there's only 17 minutes. So it's like, this is exactly like the essence of the problem or the confusion. Cause I'm like, well, should I schedule lunch every day or would it be one less special and two, like I'll never finish another book?
Frances Fry, where are we?
So, we often say that there are very few new problems. There's just a novel context. And that's, so I would put this in that category, which is what do you do when you're, you know, isolated by design? That is, your work really is a solo practitioner. And in most organizations, if you are working in isolation, we want you to be less isolated in the work because there's a co-productive nature that would make the work better. In your context, and I think this is a fun context, the co-productive nature would not make the work better. Your work is best when there is no co-production. And that's just an unusual thing. But so if your work is the work where it's really, and I think it might be close, you said you've never written books about espionage, but you might have things most in common with spies.
Ha!
Right. Oh. Which is a very, and I'm a rabid consumer of spy novels, but it's someone who it's also not a very co-productive nature. You're on your own, you're doing the things. And so what we know about that is that habits can make you feel in control. The absence of habits can make you feel out of control. Otherwise, we're going to spend all our time thinking about the boundaries and we will get nothing done. So one of the thoughts I have, and I notice you and you people can't see you, but you look to be in physically very good shape. And so I have to imagine that working out is part of the structure of your week. I don't know that for sure, though, but that feels to me that that's probably plays the role of constraints. And so that is my question to you. Do you work out?
Well, I do. Thank you for asking.
Let's just pause on that. Take that in, Curtis Sittenfeld.
I just want to say, both of you look great for all the listeners. It's true. You love them for their, you know, their brilliant brains, but they're both so pretty too. I actually take so many walks a day that I'm like my own dog or something. So like, I don't like vigorously, like I don't do like CrossFit or something, but I probably end up walking like, you know, close to 2 hours a day, which is also, tied to like, I have to get out of the house, et cetera, you know?
Yeah, I do wonder about, you know, scheduling this Monday moment. And what's the argument against scheduling some kind of similar moment on
Thursday,
like Tuesday through Friday?
Start with Thursday.
And maybe, no, I'm going all the way.
Wow.
Baby.
And this is our relationship.
And it may not be as ambitious as, you know, lunch out in the world with 3 other humans, but the way we name exercise, like a daily hygiene commitment, I almost feel like we call it something that's not cringy, which I'm not going to come up with right now, but this daily community moment. And that's partly informed for me by my reaction to COVID, which was not a good one.
Yeah.
And there were lots of lessons for me out of that moment, but one of them was how important it is to me from like we can call it something poetic, like from a soul standpoint, or we can call it mental health, or to be around other human beings and to feel connected to those other human beings and to feel connected to a community. And I heard Elizabeth Gilbert give an interview the other day, and the interviewer said something like, you know, how much time do you spend on, and I don't forget what the word was, but essentially mental health. And her answer was 75% of her day.
Yeah.
And the takeaway for me was what would 25% look like? And certainly part of that would be movement and exercise and being out in the world, but there would be another piece of that that is about community and connection and belonging. What's your reaction to the idea of a daily commitment, an intentional commitment to somehow to that connection experience.
It is interesting. And I'm also interested in the whole, like, Francis saying, maybe start with Thursday, and you saying, no, Tuesday, Wednesday, oh, yes. Thursday, Friday. I mean, I do think it would be an interesting experiment. And again, I feel that confusion, because I've, over the years, I've like been like, oh, you know, there's an exercise class, but it meets at 10 o'clock or something. And sometimes thinking like, that's such a bad time, or this. So I used to say, even like in interviews, I would say meeting someone for lunch is sort of the destroyer of productivity. And I think I'm now at a point where I'm like, I'm okay with some of my productivity being destroyed, because I want more of the human connection.
And like Elizabeth Gilbert's productivity has not been destroyed. I mean, that's the thing that was right. So
yeah.
Provocative in the best sense from hearing her come up with yeah. the number 75%. Is yeah. that she? This is also an incredibly productive human in the world, and yeah. ambitious, clearly.
Yeah. Okay, but like, what should I do? What?
Oh, now this is fun. This is like, you know, drink with a friend. Coffee with someone random who's a parent at the same school. Going for walks with another human being. I get involved in other people's projects all the time.
You know, like, all the time. She'll go off Saturday
like a
morning.
Helpful posture. And so people are like, I'm trying to start a business. You want it? I'm like, yes.
Really?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Really?
And so that's where I would say the experiment is being intentional and figuring yeah. out what's going to work for you. But do it for 2 weeks. Every single day, just schedule this moment and see what happens.
And it can range from alcohol to
in the beginning, bring alcohol. That makes it easier. Yes. Food, no food,
to
snacks.
Morning, noon, night. It can be after dinner some days. It can be late morning other days. Like, I think, and experimenting with that.
Curtis, you were writing something down, which is very exciting to Fixable hosts. Well, are you willing to share what you wrote down?
I wrote down 2 weeks, schedule it, and then I wrote alcohol, comma, different times.
Yeah. Anytime after noon. We're women of a certain age. It's fair game.
And it could be anything from alcohol to tea. Like,
yeah. Spectrum of human experiences right there.
Yeah.
Curtis, let me ask you one other thing. Are there writers or artists who you admire, who you feel like have solved this problem in a way that's intriguing to you? And I'm just thinking of Ann Patchett and her Parnassus books.
Oh, that's an interesting. I mean, I'm sure there are writers. Well, so this gets back to the same thing again that makes me lucky, makes me isolated, which is I am a full-time fiction writer. And so I've done a fair amount of volunteer work. And at times I've felt kind of tension between almost like being my writer self as a volunteer and just being a human.
Yeah.
So it's like at one point it's not exactly a food bank. It actually gives food to people who are sick. And at one point, not extensively, but a little bit, I like drove and delivered meals
or something.
Yeah, it's called Open Arms, but in Minneapolis. And so I was kind of like on the one hand, it doesn't, you know, draw on like my writing skills to drop food off at sick people's, you know, homes or apartments. And then there's also the question of like, or I could write a check to that organization. And it's not necessarily an either or thing, but it's like, is it like, I guess I don't want to do something where I'm doing it as busy work or to like boost my own sense of self-esteem. And yeah.
I think the lens we're going to push you to look through is, is it meaningful to you?
Yeah, which is nourishing to you.
Yeah, like, and does it help you feel more connected to the world, these parts of yourself that don't get expressed in a typical day in the life of Curtis?
What I would liberate myself from if I were you is, how can I do the most use to the humane society, whatever yours is? That's not the calculus. This is for my nourishment. What would I selfishly want to do?
And I think this is part of the experiment you're going to run. And I can't give up that word, Curtis, because I think it is figuring out what that metric is for you. Like, what is it that you want to think or feel or do less of when this friction is resolved? And the experiment is to try something.
Yeah, I think in a weird way, the most revelatory thing that you've said is saying, like, if I think about doing some kind of volunteer work or something, don't do what I feel like would objectively be, quote unquote, the most useful or contribute the most, like kind of think of it from a more nourishing or almost selfish perspective, which I've never thought about. And I think, again, we do not need to go deeply down this path, but I think I sometimes feel guilt about, you know, my good fortune and almost think like, what do I do to balance it out? Which again is a different question from.
It's a different question.
It's a really important question,
but totally separate.
But a totally separate question.
A different podcast.
Yeah. No, like solving for impact.
Will I be punished for being lucky?
Yeah, solving for impact. That's a different conversation. Here we want to solve for community. And, and there it may be that giving back in this way, it helps you do that as it helps countless other people.
Yeah.
Myself included. Yeah.
This is so, I mean, I know that you are very good at what you do, both of you, but this is so interesting. Thank you.
We were so delighted to have you on the show, Curtis.
So crazy delighted.
Well, Frances, that was fun.
Oh, it was so fun. It was so fun.
You know, I keep coming back to this idea of Curtis as a messenger from the future, because as you said, she's in a unique context, but this is something that so many of us are struggling with in the pandemic era.
Definitely. I think she's a beautiful messenger.
I thought one of the things that was interesting is that we're often having conversations on the show about how to get better at your job or have different outcomes at work. But this was more about what to do when things are going great. Things are going great for Curtis Sittenfeld. But there's a need that surfaces that you realize you're not meeting. So, Frances, what do you think are some takeaways for our audience from that?
So, you know, if I would put it then broadly from that frame into work-life balance, and this is someone whose work is just fine. Killing it, right?
I think that's why it's a nice
so that's why
example.
This is a beautiful example. It's an extreme example, and we do a lot of learning at the extremes.
The world would prefer Curtis not to make any changes.
Yes, no, she's killing it on the work side, and is so successful at work that she doesn't have any need for additional social things. And I thought her point about that usually our work is co-productive, so we have to do social things, or our work is not financially sustaining, so we have to do other things. She needs neither of those things. And so what do you do when you have to have a deliberate design and intentionality about the balance?
I think mental health, the word is kind of a bummer of a word. Yeah. I almost want us to find
it'd be great.
Even though 100% like to be mentally healthy is in.
No, it's just a little too literal.
But it's a little too literal, I think, because I want to bring some joy and lightness to that, because that is one of the payoffs here. But we are, I think this version of American civilization has underscored, and of course, the pandemic heightened all of this, but how core a human need this is.
Yeah, yeah.
But so many of us, like mid-career, I think in particular, think about this category of activities as an afterthought, and we need to make it more central to our days and weeks and lives. And I think for most of us, there's a beautiful cycle of feeling a deeper sense of community and connection, then allowing us to show up and be more effective public humans as well. You know, we just published a list of, you know, our 10 underrated emotions in the workplace. and fellowship, finding that community at work, which we call fellowship, was...
This was an episode on fellowship.
Was at the top of the list. And
love it.
I think for most of us, that there is huge opportunity in the workplace. I think, for Curtis, she has to go out and find
deliberate
it and be deliberate outside the workplace.
Love it. Thanks for listening. We would love to hear from you. If you want to figure out a workplace problem together, please send us a message. You can email fixable@ted.com or call us at 234-FIXABLE. That's 234-349-2253.
Fixable is brought to you by the TED Audio Collective. It's hosted by me, Anne Morris.
And me, Frances Fry.
Our team includes Isabel Carter, Constanza Gallardo, Lydia Jean Cott, Grace Rubenstein, Sarah Nix, Michelle Quint, Corey Hagem, Alejandra Salazar, Ban Ban Chang, and Roxanne Highlash. This episode was mixed by Louie at Storyyard.
If you're enjoying the show, make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And tell a friend to check us out.
And one more thing, if you can, please take a second to leave us a review. It really helps us make a great show.
And it totally helps the search algorithm.